We're ready for another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word, and we're in the final book of that inspired word, the book of Revelation, which means we'll be starting, God willing, series number 6 before too much longer in the book of Genesis. But for the moment, we are trying to stay focused on this very amazing book. And we're in chapter number 13, and I have to say it feels a little bit like we're trying to drink out of a fire hose. And there's only one way that you can really get that accomplished. You got to turn into the stream and try to catch smaller portions in your hand to slack your thirst. And so in this section, we are identifying the final beast leader and the kingdom that he leads and how it is tied in as a puppet to Satan himself, who has been cast out of heaven. He and his fallen angels, they've all been knocked down into our physical plane. And their only means of doing anything in the pursuit of their goals to oppose God is to find an earthly puppet, an earthly entity that will cooperate with them in trying to barricade planet Earth against the soon coming of Jesus. Because remember, in chapter 12, when it first started, Satan comes down to the earth with great wrath because he knows his time is short. He gets kicked out of the heavenly realm at the very beginning of the day of the Lord, the final 3.5 years. And so, in Revelation 13, let's remind ourselves of what he is up to with this beast, which is a government. Verse number 5 of Revelation 13, the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. So that's our 3.5 year period again that we've been looking at. And this beast is definitely a government, and we saw that it had some connections to past governments of history that were described in Daniel chapter 7. And we're going to go back to Daniel 7 in just a moment. But first, I want to pull in another bit of this overwhelming amount of information from Daniel chapter 2, this one. In Daniel chapter 2, Daniel has become one of the young Judeans that's going to serve on a council of advisement to King Nebuchadnezzar. And he's going through training, he and his buddies. And as they have finished that training, suddenly a dream is given by God to King Nebuchadnezzar. And King Nebuchadnezzar can't figure it out, and he doesn't want to just hand it over to his current crop of advisors. Apparently, he doesn't trust them. He's fairly new as a king. And so he won't tell them the dream. He just says, you tell me the dream and its meaning. And they eventually say, well, nobody can do that. And so he orders that all the wise men in the entirety of the Babylonian Empire be executed. And when Daniel is told that this is happening, he says, give us a little while, we'll pray, and the real God can give an answer. And he does. And you know that it is because of Daniel giving Nebuchadnezzar not just simply the dream itself, but the meaning of it, that Daniel becomes the leader. He's only like in his late teens, very early 20s at the most, but he becomes the leader of the spiritual and wisdom advisors to King Nebuchadnezzar. So in Daniel chapter 2, verse 31, cutting through all of the background, we come to where Daniel explains what the dream was and what it means. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a great statue, a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome, meaning it scared you. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast or chest and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So we have this gigantic statue, and it is made up of various types of materials, starting up at the top, the most valuable materials at the top, and going downward, becoming less valuable. But the softest material at the top, going down toward the hardest at the bottom, with one minor exception about the clay. But the statue itself is not enough. Verse 34, you continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands. So a big building block is cut out of apparently the mountainside. No humans involved in it. It just supernaturally is carved out and moved. And it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time, and it became like chaff for the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found, but the stone was struck. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So we have this multiple material statue hit in the feet, very specific, the feet, and it collapses and turns into powder, and the stone grows up and fills the world as a mountain. And mountains very often representative of government. Now, what does all that mean? Verse 36, this was the dream. Now we're going to give its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, and that term is a Persian term or a Babylonian term, an upper Mesopotamian term, and it eventually gets applied to Jesus in the book of Revelation, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. You'll see those phrases as well. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. So there's zero doubt. The Babylonian kingdom that starts with Nebuchadnezzar is the golden head. After you, or specifically after your kingdom, which is Babylonian Empire, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you that will be the Medo-Persians. We know this historically. Then another third kingdom of bronze, and we know that kingdom as well. It is the Macedonian kingdom that starts with Alexander the Great. And there's some interesting connections here, because one of the reasons that the Macedonian Greeks were so effective is because they used bronze in their equipment. So that will also rule over the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. And it is clear this is the Roman Republic, which then becomes the Roman Empire, which then becomes all the various kingdoms and countries that fall out from that Roman Empire. We call it the Western world. It is, again, interesting. The Roman military had a lot of success because they had shifted over to iron and steel as their material of choice. Now, we know that the Babylonians were followed by the Medo-Persians. The Medo-Persians were followed by the Macedonian Greeks, and the Macedonian Greeks were followed by the Romans. And this is all from the perspective of the Jewish people living in the Middle East. But what happens to Rome? Well, as I've already said, Rome becomes an empire. Rome's empire then splits into two pieces, which is interesting. We've got two legs on this statue that are made of the iron. And then those two pieces eventually disintegrate into smaller kingdoms and eventually non-royal democracies and other types of governments, like socialistic groups. But they become the modern Western world. And the whole time that the Roman Empire descends into this chaos, people are trying to put it back together again, like the whole Humpty Dumpty thing. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, and nobody could get him back together again, even though they keep trying, such as Charlemagne, who was the Holy Roman Emperor. We've got others as well, including in more modern times, Nazi Germany tried to put it all back together again and even used some of the iconography of Rome for it. And so did Italy, by the way, during World War II. The fascist symbol in Italy is all based on the Roman idea. And so everybody keeps trying to put it together. Currently, we've seen things like the European Economic Community, which became the European Union, but we've also got NATO in the mix, which tries to hold some of these groups together. The United Nations, many of its major players come from countries that descend from the fallen apart Roman Empire. And so it is interesting that we read in verse 42 of Daniel 2, as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery or clay, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. Sorry, I kind of skipped over 41. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. That's the chaos that ensues in the fallout from the Roman Empire. And verse 41 continues, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and some of it will be brittle. Now, I want you to file away in your head the idea that there are 10 toes on the common human body. And so when we get to the book of Revelation, where the number 10 comes up, we'll shift from the imagery being toes representing 10 kings to 10 horns on one head of this final beast. And it will still be the same thing, that these are leaders that are having a hard time hanging out with other leaders. Verse 43, and in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. If you know anything about European history, you know that a lot of history is all about the back and forth between, okay, you marry my daughter, or my son will marry your daughter, or this, that, and the other. And these kingdoms are trying to make deals back and forth, trying to have power plays. They try to make alliances, but they're all of them are still trying to be the ones that are in control when it's all said and done. And the modern day European Union, you still see that going on in it. You see it happening in NATO. You see it happening in the United Nations. Everybody is trying to be on the top of the heap to control the whole. And that's exactly what this statue finishes with down at its base. You've got all of these fallout from the broken up Roman Empire trying to be in control. But what happens? Verse 44. In the days of those kings, meaning the 10 kings down at the bottom, the 10 toes, which in Revelation will be 10 horns. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. That's Jesus returning right there. That's Jesus coming as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and his millennial kingdom being the first phase of the eternal kingdom. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone, and of course Jesus is that stone, was cut out of the mountain without hands, so he is divine, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king that it will take place in the future, so the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. So in effect, Daniel chapter 2 stretches from the 6th century of the of BC right up into our time today, awaiting the second coming of Jesus. Because when Jesus comes, the final government, the final world government will fall to his kingdom. And we've already seen that in the wording of chapter number 12, when Satan is kicked out of the heavenly realm. Now, back to Daniel chapter 7, where, again, it's the same story starting in the time of the Babylonians, but this time it's a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. It's the last king of the Babylonian Empire. And we are told this in Daniel chapter 7, that Daniel is looking in verse 2, and the four winds are stirring up the great sea. That'd be the Med. One of the things about all of these empires we keep talking about is they are centered around the Mediterranean basin. Four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. That's the iconography, the imagery of the pet winged lions of Ishtar. And you can even see that imagery on the Ishtar Gate built by King Nebuchadnezzar at Babylon. And so I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a human mind was given to it. And so there's a human being that's in control of the Babylonian government as Daniel is having this dream. And that human thinks he's got it all together, but he's about to get his wings clipped and be taken down, and the next kingdom is going to come. Verse 5, behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. It was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise and devour much meat. This in the series is clearly Medo-Persia, which took over the Babylonian Empire area and expanded on it. One of the things that we see in the imagery of the Medo-Persian Empire is the lopsidedness of it. We see it as a bear here. There were bears, by the way, in the mountains of what we call Iran today, which was part of the Medo-Persian region. And this bear is lopsided. It's bigger on one side. It's lifted up on one side. In Daniel chapter 8, when we are seeing Medo-Persia described, without a doubt, it is a ram, and it's lopsided in its horns this time. One horn is bigger than the other and comes up at a different time than the other. And so this is the next kingdom that Daniel is aware comes on the scene after Babylon. Verse 6, after this I kept looking, behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And I mentioned this a lot last time. The imagery here is clearly about Alexander the Great's Macedonian expansion. Alexander the Great is even portrayed in imagery of his time period, riding on the back of a leopard coming back from the Middle East. He's dressed up as if he's Dionysius, because there was an old Greek story about the god Dionysius going off to the Middle East and bringing back all sorts of interesting things for the Greek people. And he comes back riding in a chariot behind four leopards. Leopards, of course, are very fast. Put some bird wings on those leopards, and they get supercharged. And we know that the Greek expansion from Macedonia all the way out to the Himalayan foothills and down into Egypt, it happened in a matter of years, just over a decade. So it was lightning fast. It was a blitzkrieg of the time. And the idea that we see in the rest of chapter 8, by the way, Alexander the Great's kingdom is represented as this goat that starts with one horn, Alexander the Great. But in attacking the Medo-Persian ram, it breaks that horn off. Alexander the Great died at a very young age while he was still in his campaigns. And it's replaced by four horns. Just like here, there's four wings and four heads. And we know that in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's death, eventually we settle down to four key Macedonian regions. And two of them have Israel bracketed. To the north is the Seleucids. To the south are the Ptolemies. Now, that is clear then in verse 6 that Babylon will be followed by Media-Persia. Media-Persia will be followed by Macedonian Greeks. And that leaves then the Romans in verse 7. After this, I kept looking in the night visions. Behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrifying, extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. There's our imagery again. The iron boot of Rome, the iron spearhead, the iron sword of Rome. It devoured and it crushed and it trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, this is where it gets very interesting, and we're going to run out of time before too much longer, so hang in there. I know it's hard to drink while this blast is coming, but we've got to absorb it before Revelation chapter 13 and following makes any more sense. When Rome comes on the scene, it overwhelms everything else that's already been there, but it keeps incorporating bits and pieces of the previous cultures. And so the Babylonians don't totally disappear. They just kind of get absorbed by the Medo-Persians. The Medo-Persians don't just disappear. They get absorbed by the Macedonian Greeks. And the Macedonian Greeks don't disappear. They get absorbed by the Roman Republic, and which then becomes the Roman Empire. And then over time, as I've already stressed, the Roman Empire falls into two bits, Western and Eastern. Each of those bits then disintegrates into individual kingdoms and then to individual countries, all of which we conveniently refer to as the Western world. And that includes the colonizations that happened by European groups into North and South America and down into Africa as well, down into the south tip of Africa. So this empire didn't really ever totally go away. It looked like it did. It kind of looked like it died. But eventually, it will come back to life. And it will come back to life, I believe, shortly before the day of the Lord begins. One of the things we've already read out of Paul's writings is that people will be saying peace and security, and then sudden destruction will come upon them like a flood. That's a description of the breaking of the sixth seal and the beginning of this of the 3.5-year day of the Lord. So people will have their eyes focused on the idea, if we can just get a united government over most of the planet, or at least over most of the controlling entities of this planet, we can have peace and security. And guess what? That is definitely what the European Union has been trying to do. It is what NATO had been tasked with trying to take care of as the fallout of World War II. And it is also what the United Nations has always been trying to devote itself to. In fact, you'll find those words, the actual Greek words, in the Greek charter for the United Nations. So I think this idea of a commitment to a world cooperative government is where we will be whenever things fall apart at the beginning of the final 3.5-year day of the Lord. A little bit more on that as we get back into the Word next time, right here in Daniel chapter 7.